Ecclesiastes is a bit weird, right? It's an interesting existential, at times slightly unsettling, somewhat depressing book, in a way that I don't think any other Bible book quite is. Occasionally, it feels a little bit like Proverbs, but we journey much closer with the author through his extended reflections and his struggles as he shares his frustration at the limitations of his understanding. He cannot figure out what the point of life is. His opening question in chapter 1, verse 3, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? What benefit is there? What return is there on all this living? And lacking an answer, he cries out with his kind of motto phrase, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Does that sound like something you're supposed to say in church, I wonder? He goes on to say some other strange things. Be not overly righteous and do not make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? He says shocking things like the stillborn child is better off than the man who fathers 100 children and lives many years. He says he hated life. Is that okay? Lots of discussion has been had over whether the author of Ecclesiastes is a believer. Can it be okay for a man of God to say all is vanity? And it has led some people to suggest that the author is experimenting with an atheistic or skeptical or ungodly worldview. All is vanity without God. But, you know, we have God, so no need to worry. Is he an atheist? Is he pretending to be an atheist? Is he a faithful believer? Is he maybe one of those false teachers that 2 Peter warned us about? There's a question on your sheets, if you've got the handout, and I'd love you to have a go at it. So there's a quote. Do you agree or disagree? And how would you argue it? Chat about that with the people next to you. Good. We don't have enough time for long discussions, so that's all you get. I think we can very easily say that the author is not an atheist. God is not absent from Ecclesiastes. He's actually mentioned a lot. He's all over the book. The author of Ecclesiastes definitely believes in God. In fact, he believes lots of normal things about God. Lots of normal biblical truths. He believes in an eternal creator God. Chapter 3, chapter 12. He believes in sin. 7 verse 20. Surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. Very normal belief. He believes that this world is under God's curse. He basically quotes Genesis 3. All are from the dust and to dust all return. He believes wisdom is better than folly and light is better than darkness. He believes God will judge the righteous and the wicked, even if he's not quite sure when or how that will happen. He believes we should fear God and that it will be better for those who do than for the sinner who prolongs his life while doing evil. That all sounds like a pretty solid theological foundation to me. And if you can turn with me to the end of Ecclesiastes, chapter 12, incidentally, when I first studied Ecclesiastes, I was surprised at how long it was, because I feel like we only ever teach the first couple of chapters. There are 12 chapters in Ecclesiastes. But the book ends with an epilogue that is written by somebody else. So the last 5 verses are written by somebody else. And chapter 12, starting at verse 9, besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They are given by one shepherd. Ecclesiastes ends with a stamp of approval. These are words of truth and God-given. So if you found yourself actually connecting quite a lot with Ecclesiastes, then that is okay. If he sometimes voiced your own questions, then maybe it's actually encouraging that the Bible doesn't shy away from that kind of theological struggle. There's a kind of raw honesty to it, and he seems to be a faithful believer facing up to life's big questions. But who was he? Who was Ecclesiastes? So Ecclesiastes is apparently Greek for a person who calls an assembly. I don't know whether that's true or not, but that, you know, apparently that's true. He's technically anonymous, referred to by his pseudonym, which I probably can't pronounce correctly, Koheleth, translated in the ESV as the preacher. And we know some things about him. So we know he's the son of David, king in Jerusalem. We know he's king over Israel in Jerusalem. We know he acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before him. We know he became great and surpassed all who were before him in Jerusalem, and his wisdom remained with him. And we know, besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The first obvious candidate for the preacher is Solomon. Solomon was the direct son and heir of David, inheriting the throne of all united Israel, i.e. before the kingdom split under his son. God gave him wisdom and understanding beyond measure, 1 Kings 4, verse 29. King Solomon excelled all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom, 2 Chronicles chapter 9. He also spoke 300 proverbs, including most of the book Proverbs, and the descriptions of his wealth seem to fit, as well as his many wives and concubines. Under him, the Bible even says, Judah and Israel ate and drank and were happy, which sounds kind of familiar from Ecclesiastes 2. But not everyone agrees. So Solomon is not named in the book, as he is in Proverbs and the Song of Songs. And the preacher almost rules Solomon out when he says he has surpassed all who were before him in Jerusalem. Solomon is only the third king of Israel and only the second to reign from Jerusalem, I think. And the preacher claims his wisdom remained with him, which, if the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, Solomon's wisdom seems to fail when he gets old and his wives turn away his heart after other gods. It would be unusual for a king of Judah to be described as king over Israel, though, after the kingdom has split. Not unheard of, but unusual. Hezekiah and Josiah are both sons of David, both kings of Judah, and they are described as being greater than all the kings that came before them and after. So maybe that slightly fits. Interestingly, wisdom, specifically the wisdom of Solomon, seems to have flourished again under King Hezekiah. So if you read Proverbs, there's a reference there. So there's slightly more options than we might have originally thought. Maybe it's deliberately written to sound like Solomon, even if it's somebody else. Maybe it's written about somebody who genuinely was a lot like Solomon, even though they weren't. I still think it probably was Solomon. But whether you're totally sold on that or not, I suggest we refer to him, as the book does, as the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. If it is Solomon, though, or to be honest, even if it just sounds like Solomon, then I assume the author also wants us to think about that period of history, to remember the high point of Israel in the Old Testament. Under Solomon, the kingdom reaches the height of its power, and it's at its closest to inheriting all the promises of God. They have lots of people. They live in the promised land. They are blessed. The nations come to them to be blessed. They have a wise Davidic king who builds a temple where God dwells with them as their God. It kind of doesn't get better than that for Israel. What a time to discover that all is vanity. The consequences of the fall and God's curse, they continue to be felt, and nothing appears to ease the pain despite all that wealth, success, and wisdom. And because of where we are in the Bible story, that the preacher wrestles with the limits of the revelation available to him. He knows God is good. He knows God judges justly. He knows it's better to be righteous. But chapter 8, verse 14, there is a vanity that takes place on earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. and there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. Gandalf kind of had it right. Many that live deserve death, and some that die deserve life. Can you give it to them, Frodo? And the preacher knows he can't. He can't give it to them. Nor can he escape that harsh reality himself. However you lived, even if you were blessed with wealth and women and wisdom, the wise dies just like the fool. The same event happens to all of them. Everybody dies eventually. So what was the point of that? And the preacher has very little by way of answers to those questions. God has not yet revealed his promise of a new heavens and a new earth where death will be swallowed up forever. God hasn't yet revealed his plans for the resurrection of the dead. He's about to reveal all of that. Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, they are followed by the book of Isaiah, where God announces he is about to do something new and big. And as Israel declines from Solomon onwards, all the prophets that God sends contribute to this new radical, expansive, eternal, curse-canceling salvation plan, promising something that goes way beyond just the earthly kingdom of Israel, even when it was at its best. So how do we read Ecclesiastes? In God's kindness, he has now fully revealed his salvation plan. So we need to bear that in mind as we apply the book. We're not in the same situation as Mr. Preacher. But can I suggest that lots of the application in Ecclesiastes will still come through following the preacher's train of thought and mulling on it yourself. Give yourself proper time to chew over Ecclesiastes and don't leap too quickly to, but we know Jesus, as if this book's just not relevant anymore for a New Testament believer. This may be obvious, but we still live in the same fallen, finite world. Christians are not immune to God's curse just because we now know how God will fix it. I've given you my purpose statement. I don't think it's very good, but I've given it to you anyway. It's on slide 2 in case you haven't flipped over. This is my working purpose statement. God has cursed all life under the sun. In fear and joy, long for something better. And I will try with these four applications to explain why that's what I've gone for. You can also probably see I've tried to smuggle in a few purposes because I couldn't choose. So over the year, you can help me to refine. But here are four applications that I think that the book encourages us towards. Number one, be a humble creature and fear your creator in the face of the curse and judgment. And that's, you know, that's probably the most obvious instruction in the book, fear God. It's where the book concludes. God has, we find out, deliberately limited our understanding. And at least partly that seems to be so that we get the dynamic in the relationship right. He is sovereign, judge, creator. And we, of course, do not know all his work. That was intentional to teach us our place, to teach us how serious sin is. And so when you experience the vanity of the world, it is a humbling reminder that we are cursed. Number two, stop defaulting to a this world solution for vanity, dissatisfaction, and injustice. We are easily sucked back into thinking that we can fix all the problems in the world and escape the vanity by working hard and living wisely, which is exactly what happens in the book. The preacher has seen and tried everything under the sun. And he says, who can make straight what God has made crooked? No one. So stop believing that lie. Number three, enjoy God's gifts in this world rightly, knowing they are fleeting. And this is maybe the most surprising application. And I wonder if you felt that as you read through the book. The preacher repeatedly tells us there is nothing better than to be joyful and enjoy what God has given. it sometimes feels like quite a confusing step of logic, considering most of the book is so bleak. But it is throughout the book, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 5, chapter 8, chapter 9, chapter 11. And often it's something like, eat, drink, and be merry. Can that be right? I think we are quick to jump in and say, no, preacher, there is something better. 1 Corinthians 15 says, in light of the resurrection, throw ourselves into the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord our labor is not in vain. There is a labor now, which is not all vanity. And eat, drink, for tomorrow we die, that becomes the motto of the resurrection denier. Can that be right? But the preacher isn't suggesting ungodly, unrestrained pleasure seeking. He's big on fearing God. He just also affirms a godly thankfulness. The joy he commends is moderated heavily by the honest, often painful truth that nothing lasts. But food and drink are still gifts from God, as are toil and work and wealth and possessions and power. These are God's gifts to man, he says. And God has made everything beautiful in its time. So as humbled, thankful creatures, enjoying those gifts is right and good when we acknowledge they came from the hand of God and are fleeting. There is purpose in the beauty as well as the vanity. And I think we shouldn't jump over that as we apply. How are we doing for time? Number 4. Long for a world without curse. And that's where I sort of land on my purpose statement. That may not have seemed like a very real possibility for an original reader, I guess. But I think it was a real longing. The preacher's congregation, they just have to kind of fear God and carry on. But the dissatisfaction they feel is preparation for new revelation. The dissatisfaction is preparation for new revelation. A kind of, we can't do anything to fix this, but maybe God will. And for the Christian then, this one gets kind of tweaked the most, I think, because in our longing, we now know to look beyond this world under the sun to God's revealed salvation, the resurrected Jesus, Son of David, King in heavenly Jerusalem. And that is where to hope when we long for a world without curse. We are running out of time. I've put a structure on your sheets. I'm not going to really talk about it. Read any commentary on Ecclesiastes and they will give you a different structure. There is no agreement on structure. So this is probably wrong, at least in part. Ed's, I think, is different. So if you're a student group, he'll probably give you another one. You can just cross this one out. All is vanity. But I've put a few things on your sheet. If you want to have a go at working out the structure of Ecclesiastes, then I'd encourage you to do that. There's a few things to get you started, kind of data points that might be of interest as you do that. While we wait to, for the student team to reappear, please will you talk about that question on your sheet. How will this book be good for you? Talk about that with the people next to you.